Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times bestselling author and award-winning environmental reporter Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott, and this is Welcome to Florida. It has become a tradition. We start the episode talking about water. And again, Craig Pittman in his latest Florida Phoenix column, floridaphoenix.com, has found another avenue with which to approach Florida's seemingly daily increasing water woes.
Yeah, it's, you know, people have paid so much attention to what's been going on in this legislative session that's been absolutely bonkers. You know, they're trying to impose a limit on cities that want to stop using fertilizer in the summer. They want to make our roads out of phosphate waste, even though it's radioactive. And so somehow this very small but very important bill slipped past almost unnoticed. Politico did something on it. Bruce Ritchie from Politico caught it, where he wrote about, and so I wrote about, how this bill passed that basically sets things up. And this is what's happened in other states when these bills have passed. Big companies will come in and buy up little municipal water and sewer systems and then jack up the rates. One place in Pennsylvania, the rates have gone up 90% since the new owners have taken over. And this sets it up basically for that to happen here in Florida. And, you know, if you've been struggling with your gasoline and grocery and property insurance bills already, the idea that your water and sewer bills are going to go up 90% is not a comforting one.
Yeah. And, you know, for a long, long time, one of the real attractions to Florida was the cost of living.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right? Exactly.
No income tax. Dirt low property taxes, but now look at the price of housing. You mentioned property insurance and you know, some broad-based inflation due to corporate profiteering and the COVID and supply chain issues. But, you know, you start working that down now to, you know, the water bill. And it's you know, that huge, you know, all those middle class, lower middle class people in Wisconsin and Michigan and Illinois and Indiana, all those people who would previously retire to Tampa and vote no on everything. It's not so easy. Easy living is not so easy, you know, in Florida anymore. And that's another little example why. FloridaPhoenix.com. All right, Craig, we are just about there with the Patreon.com/WelcomeToFlorida. Sponsorship effort. So I'm calling it. And we've both got some travel coming up, but we are going to release a new episode exclusively for our patrons who have signed up $5 a month at patreon.com/WelcomeToFlorida. And we're going to release a behind the scenes episode in June that explains how the sausage is made here on Welcome to Florida and gives you a little idea of our workflow and how we got together and kind of our backgrounds and that sort of thing.
Sure. So
we
want to have to tell you, I like bacon better than sausage. So, you know,
well, we want to thank everyone who's supported us for $5 a month at patreon.com/Welcome to Florida. If you want to get that bonus episode exclusive to the Patreons, you've still got some time to head over there, patreon.com/WelcomeToFlorida, and that's going to be coming out in June. Also want to begin, hey, hurricane preparedness season, right? It's right here. And once again, Windstorm Products is going to be sponsoring the podcast throughout hurricane seasons. And if you are a coastal homeowner like Craig in St. Pete or myself here in Fernandina Beach are, you can never be too prepared for hurricane season and you're running out of time, but you know, you still have those opportunities. Get in touch with our friends at Windstorm Products. They are the largest online retailer of hurricane hardware in the world. Prepare your home for hurricane season. Shop windstormproducts.com. Hurricane hardware, shutter installation tools. They've got an 800 number there, so you can talk to them and say, hey, here's where I live, and here's how the wind comes, and I haven't had trouble with this or haven't with that. Here's my flooding situation, all these kind of things. They will give you the expertise so that you're not just buying stuff, and then you've got all these packages delivered at your door, and you don't know what the heck to do with them. windstormproducts.com. That's where you can get started today to make your house more secure from hurricane wind damage. Interesting guest today that is going to kind of another one of our city episodes to go along with Tallahassee and Eatonville and Jacksonville that we've had recently, Pensacola. We're heading nearby to you. Ybor City is the focus today, Craig.
Yes. In this fascinating book about Ybor City, the history of Ybor City, the role of women in protesting for better conditions, better working conditions, and so forth, and in the tobacco industry, protesting fascism. And it's a fascinating book about a fascinating area that now is known mostly just as a tourist attraction for people who are interested in the bars and the restaurants, you know, the original Columbia restaurant and so forth are there. But there's just so much deep history there. And she tells a great story.
Sarah McNamara is the guest. She's her family goes back generations in Ybor City. This is a fascinating conversation. The book just released in April of 2023. There'll be a link to purchase in the show notes. Ybor City, Crucible of the Latina South. And Sarah is our guest today.
Thanks so much for joining us today. You know, we have sort of touched on the subject of Ybor City in a couple of our other shows. We did one on the Columbia restaurant, the oldest restaurant in Florida. We did maybe our most controversial one about Cuban sandwiches.
You have strong feelings about the Cuban sandwich.
Yes, you'd be amazed. But tell people, just in case they don't know, where is Ybor City and how did it wind up in the location that it's in?
Absolutely. So if listeners aren't familiar with Ybor City is now a neighborhood within Tampa, but it was initially its own municipality. It's located on the eastern edge of Hillsborough County. And what created the community was the Cuban cigar industry. So during the 1880s, in the midst of the process of the Cuban War for Independence, one of the issues was a sense of continuity in terms of manufacturing. The manufacturers who worked on the island of Cuba, they decided to move their factories, and they initially did so to Key West. The concept of moving to Tampa became to create a company town model. So looking at other manufacturing towns throughout the United States and how they can maximize profits in different ways, right? Through worker housing, through having grocery stores, things where they can control prices and can control labor. And so they decided to move up to the Tampa area. There was ample land. Tampa had only around 700 residents at the time. They were eager for investment. And one man named Vicente Martinez Ybor, he bought the largest parcel of land on that eastern outskirts. And that's what became Ybor City. So those who came to work there, they were at once looking for work, but also for a political refuge. And that is something that is highly important when we think about Ybor City, that Ybor City has a politic of labor and of union organizing and of political ideologies that are very different from what you find in South Florida. And it was a sense of self that lasted for generations.
But you talk about it being a company town, though, and that, you know, that we think of the steel company towns are very anti-labor, incredibly exploitative. Was there a different labor management relationship in Ybor than what was established with the steel companies in Pennsylvania?
I mean, so Ybor himself is pretty open that he's looking for a way to control labor. The entire concept of moving from Key West is in Key West there, the manufacturers are experiencing a high level of volatility, right? So the cigar workers in Key West, they're striking rather regularly. There is a massive fire that burns down different cigar factories. So they're looking at steel manufacturers and mill towns as how do we replicate what these people are experiencing to have a higher sense of control? And they speak about it openly, and that is what they seek to do. So when they move to Ybor City, there's not a highly functional relationship between Ybor himself and the union organizing. In fact, his entire outlook was, if I create these nice houses where people have a higher standard of living, if I do these things, then people are going to be happy and there won't be a need to strike. And he actually experiences the opposite. People bring their politics with them. And just the virtue of moving the site of cigar manufacturing doesn't change that. If anything else, it creates a space where grassroots organizing becomes stronger, even though it's isolated. And the cigar workers create this one union called, that's popularly called La Resistencia, so the resistance. It didn't have any association with an AFL or any, you know, national group that would have been popular at the time. Their entire idea was that they wanted to organize on their own terms by blending politics and unionism together. So the concept that Ybor is creating is very much following that model that we now understand as exploitative. He understood it as controlling labor for, right, maximizing profits. That's what he wanted. Yeah.
Now, you have a personal connection to this story that you emphasize in your book. Can you tell people a little bit about what that is?
Absolutely. And I know listeners don't know this, but last night we did the launch of the book. And one of the questions that I was asked was, you know, like, was your family initially in it? So, and they weren't. It took me a long time to feel comfortable writing my family into the story. And even to the extent that I did, which is limited in the book. Sometimes there's characters who come up who you don't know I'm actually related to them because I don't identify them, but sometimes I am. My family is from Ybor City. The first people from my family immigrated around the turn of the century, so around 1906, from Cuba to Ybor City, and they worked in the cigar factories. So that was something that was very much a part of my experience growing up here in Florida, that Ybor City was a place that was alive to me, even though Ybor City had very much changed by the time that I was coming of age. I was right in elementary and middle school in the 90s and in high school in the early 2000s. So Ybor City was a very different place than it was in the context of my book, looking at it during the cigar industry era from the 1880s through the 1960s when things really start to shift. But Ybor always played this special place in my life, and my grandmother in particular worked to keep that alive. And what she wanted us to know was what it meant to be of and from Ybor City. So I grew up, you know, doing Noche Buena. We were very much aware of, we celebrated May Day, which I did not know was abnormal until I got older, and that there was a politic connected to it. It's so very much the traditions that were a part of Ybor City were something that were dear to me. And as I got older and became a professional historian, one of the things I wanted to do was to talk about the differences of what it means to be Cuban and live in Florida. That there's very much a popularized idea, right, that there's one sense of Cubanidad within the state, but it's actually highly divergent, right? We're talking about four different migrant groups, all of whom understand themselves differently, let alone the children who are a part and descendants of different groups of migrants who've made a home in Florida. And understanding those differences are really a part of understanding Florida, right, beyond the headlines.
One thing I think people will find surprising is the very large role that women played in a lot of these movements that you write about. In particular, I don't mean to jump too far ahead, but the March of 5,000.
Yes.
That was incredible. That's incredible. Can you tell people a little bit about how the women came to power? But maybe that's a good way to get into that.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you look at other studies of Ybor City and you're talking about, right, those histories of unionism, you're going to find a much more typical story that you hear in earlier labor histories, right, where typical unions are led and privileged men's labor as well. So they're led by men and they're generally defending men's wages, right? That was one of the largest complaints that women who were laborers and part of unions and working class had. That's true also to an extent in Ybor City. If we're looking at, you know, between 1885 and the 1920s, the majority of women are working as despalilladoras, so the strippers who remove the stem from the tobacco leaf, or they're working as boncheras, so they're sitting next to cigar workers who are rolling cigars, but they're not doing the highest paid positions within factories. And the unions, even though they had sections that supported this form of labor, they didn't really defend them in the same way. My book is different because it really looks at 1930s onward in a really intense way. So I give less attention to the earlier period and much more to the later generations, or as I'm talking about, the multiple US born generations. And in the 1930s, the cigar industry collapses. So many close their doors, many change the way that labor operates. And one of the solutions that manufacturers come to in order to save their businesses is to fire en masse men who are cigar rollers and hire in their place women who are cigar makers. And they then become, by virtue, the primary employed within Ybor City, which also means that unions are now defending the labor of women as the primary wage earning people within the community and also within the cigar making trade. This puts women in a particular, you know, position of power. They have economic power. They have power of what union politics looks like, which means that they have power over the politics of the community in a specific way. But also the 30s is when everything comes to a head, when people are no longer okay, right? You have all these men without jobs. They need access to WPA assistance. They can't work in Ybor City. They're going to have to work somewhere else. The restrictions within Tampa, the difference between being Latinx and being Anglo, meant that people were barred from public spaces, but also from getting jobs. But when men organized, there was collective resistance against that that came in the form of vigilante violence, that came in the form of murder. But women, it was different. Women were able to collectively mobilize without the same visceral repercussions. And in the 1930s, they become the mouthpieces for this. So the March of 5,000, right, Craig, that you were talking about, the 1937, I call it the 1937 Anti-Fascist Women's March, which if any of the listeners make their way down to Ybor City, there is now an historical marker and mural in Ybor City that is commemorating this, right on 7th Avenue. And what these women were doing is that they were advocating for the United States to change its position on the Spanish Civil War. They were protesting against the rise of fascism around the globe, as well as within the city of Tampa, and the United States' refusal to condemn it. And they become these very active, very outspoken, very physical women who are saying, hey, all of these conditions are not okay. And the rise of fascist politics that we see across the Atlantic Ocean exists here in these kinds of ways. And if we're not going to address all of these, how are we any different? And they continue this campaign for a process of 3 years. And they're rather successful in making change locally in the way of beginning the process of getting Latinos into positions of political power within the city of Tampa. So when you look at the city of Tampa's, you know, political, I guess, milieu or landscape, it's much different than what you see in other places, but also the history behind it is particular.
And the inciting incident for the march, correct me if I'm wrong, was the bombing of Guernica.
Yeah, the bombing of Guernica, right? The bombing of Guernica happens right towards the end of April, and they mobilize this march within a period of 7 days. So within a seven-day period of time, yeah, you have 5,000 people who are marching down 7th Avenue, and they march from Ybor City all the way to the front steps of the of City Hall, where they are protesting to the mayor. And one of the things that's so outstanding about this moment is that it's really the first time that people from Ybor City are asking those within the city of Tampa or representatives to stand and to defend and to support them. Because really before the 1930s, they didn't need them to. Well, who they were talking to were manufacturers. They wanted an increase of wages. All of a sudden, the idea of being a citizen starts to matter. So how you're being treated right by those who are citizens matters.
Yeah, that's amazing. To give a little context, Guernica, as an arts writer, is my favorite painting.
Oh, Pablo yeah,
Picasso
is it?
Painted Guernica. It's on view in Madrid for anyone who wants to go. This was the Nazis essentially supporting Franco by bombing from the air civilian populations. It's the first time that had ever happened in world history, and it obviously sent shockwaves around the globe, reaching all the way to Ybor City in Florida. So that's a remarkable anecdote of history there. You mentioned that the cigar industry collapsed in the 30s. Was that due to the Depression?
Yes.
By and large?
Yeah. Due to the Depression. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The 1920s, they were at the peak of their profit margins. So the decline that happens in the 1930s is rather stark. It's rather quick. And it has an intense reverberating effect. Following that, there's also changes that happen in terms of mechanizing cigar production. But at the same time, right in the 30s, people aren't buying high-priced cigars anymore. They're buying cheap cigarettes. Cigarettes are more economical. They're easy to buy. Mm-hmm. They're easier to make, right? They're addictive, all of these things in a different way than cigars.
When did Ybor, I guess, become subsumed by Tampa and stop being this kind of Cuban enclave of cigar production and really just being one of many neighborhoods around this sprawling Florida city?
So technically, Ybor City stops being its own independent municipality really early. So Ybor City comes to exist in 1885. By 1887, the city of Tampa has annexed it.
Oh, wow.
As a part of the city itself. And it does it in a way where there's no election. There's no input from anybody living within Ybor City, including Ybor himself, who feels surprised and sidelined by what happens. It is a dictate that comes from the governor's office, where there is an executive order that is signed that leads to the incorporation of Ybor City into the city of Tampa. So it loses its independence pretty early on. And when it loses its independence, that's when things like city of Tampa policing come into effect. That's when forced orders of segregation come into effect. There's different policies that were commonplace in Florida and Tampa that now apply to Ybor City that didn't necessarily apply before. And if there's any listeners who are familiar with the Tampa area, you all will know that there's two communities that are side by side that were cigar making. So there's Ybor City and West Tampa. West Tampa's right claim to fame is that they remained independent much longer. They did not become, you know, part of Tampa until during the early 1920s. They maintained that sense of independence a little bit longer, but it is perhaps notable within that sense of independence that West Tampa was developed not by an immigrant not by an immigrant manufacturer like Ybor. It was developed by a man named Hugh McFarland, who was among the Tampa elite, who created a community that was very similar to Ybor City as a way to, you know, maximize his own profits.
I want to get into some of the more macro issues you talked about. And I think one that's going to be of great interest to many people, including the two folks you're talking to right now. You mentioned this, the difference between these four migrant groups to South Florida, the difference between Miami and Tampa Cuban populations. Flesh that out for us a little bit, because it's not accurate to lump all these people together, obviously.
Right. It's not accurate to lump everybody together. So if we even take, let's say, Ybor City and Miami as like two case studies, right? Those who come to Ybor City, they come in the 1880s, and the migration really stops from the island around the 1930s. There are some people who come during the Machado regime, right, which is a strongman regime on the island itself prior to Batista. And the way that people describe themselves is that they're coming in search of work, and they call themselves many times political exiles. So they see themselves as fleeing from a elite and corrupt government that is on the island. This group of people, right, they have a more progressive politic over time. They become the foundation of the Democratic Party within the city of Tampa. Whereas if we look at Miami, we're looking at a migration that begins in 1959. Those who came were predominantly, you know, had been middle or upper middle and upper class. They were predominantly white. They had a very different sense of self and understanding than those who were in Tampa. There's one great story that I tell in the book where I'm explaining, right, why refugee settlement was not in Tampa and it's focused on Miami. And a part of it, I mean, of course, like proximity, but there's also finding a way for people to get along. And the interaction of these two different groups in Tampa was explosive. Many people from Ybor City were initially rather sympathetic of the Castro regime. They'd been a part of wanting to see a Cuba for Cubans, but they weren't necessarily organizing for it, right? They didn't care as much by the time that it was the early 1960s because they had lived here for so long. Whereas in Miami, right, that sense was very much tied to wanting to go back home, to what Castro meant, what it changed for those who decided to come to Tampa, or for those who decided to come to Miami. So you end up with two different locations that have two different politics, right? One that's defining itself in terms of fleeing and wanting to see an independent Cuba and talking about labor unionism and progressive politics. And the other one that is understanding itself in the midst of the Cold War era, right? That is vehemently anti-Castro, that has a different sense of economic privilege than the other, not identifying as working class. And over time, they create different portions of political parties where those in Miami become increasingly conservative, whereas those in Tampa, by and large, remain a part of the Democratic Party, even if that's much more moderate than, you know, their parents and grandparents.
Forefathers. Yeah. And I thought that was fascinating, you know, flipping through the book and reading some descriptions about it. These Cubans in Ybor, they're radicals. They are revolutionaries. Yeah. I mean, they would be considered leftists and progressives, whereas you know, as recently as today, Cubans in Miami, by and large, I shouldn't say that, many Cubans in Miami support fascism, vote for Trump, vote for DeSantis. So that is a key distinction in my head to make about the wide disparity between the perspectives of these groups, despite having sort of this, you know, ancestral, you know, commonality.
Chad, you may recall when we talked to David Powell, he talked about how even the first waves of refugees from Cuba who came to Miami were looking down on the Marriott folks when they came.
I got mine. Oh, absolutely. No one else.
Right. Mariel's another, another migrant group that is understood differently and who also understands themselves differently. Yeah. Right? Which is one thing, like, you don't want to paint Cubans in Florida with a broad brush, even though, you know, we all want to if we're, you know, sitting down and, you know, turning on news on television. Is, you know, the experience of being somebody who came during Mariel, the experience of being somebody who is a child of those who came in the early 60s and who's grown up in Miami and has grown up in the South as somebody who is Latino, like, will have a very different understanding of self.
Well, and forget about just Cubans specifically. You know, you watch all these political analysts and all these pollsters, they want to talk about Latin people. So now we're bringing in Haiti and Mexico and Guatemala. So, I mean, it is a cautionary tale that even within Cuba, the migrant groups and perspectives are not the same, let alone Latin America broadly.
Yeah.
Exactly. The way that I try to make it as simple as possible in the book when I'm setting this up in the introduction, but I'm just like, you know, there's this one coffee company in Ybor City called Naviera. It's the oldest coffee mill that was here. When the coffee grounds that are used in Café con Leche in Ybor City or for cortados or espresso or demitas, it is a blend that includes chicory. And it's what people grew to like because it stretched, right? The, you know, they were working class. It stretched the ration a bit longer. Whereas the same company sells a different blend for its clients in Miami because it's a darker roast. It's pure. There's no chicory in it. And the way I explained it is, you know, the difference between living in Tampa and living in Miami and being Cuban is evident in something as simple as the coffee you drink.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Everybody calls it café con leche, but it's going to taste different depending on where you are because your tastes are different and they're informed by when you came in, you know, the environment that you lived in.
One of the key factors, I guess, I hate to jump backwards in time, but one of the key factors in the radicalism of the folks working in the cigar factories was the lectors, was it not?
Yes, the lectors. Yes. So the lectors, it's a pretty interesting institution. So if anybody's ever seen I say this as though everybody has seen this, an image of a cigar factory, right? You'll see all of these workers sitting at benches rolling cigars. But if you pay close attention, you'll probably see somebody on these stilts and he's sitting up there and reading a newspaper. And the lector, what he did is that he read newspapers, performed plays, kept people abreast of what was going on. So in Ybor City and in general, the lector was in Ybor City as well as on the island of Cuba. This does not exist in the northeast where there was also, you know, cigar making going on. The lector was employed by the cigar workers themselves. So they hired him and they fired him. It had nothing to do with the manufacturers, which meant they got to control what they listened to. They got to control what he read. And if they didn't like what they were saying, they were out of it. And that was something that was endemic to their education. They were very politically engaged. And they were reading things that range from the Daily Worker all the way to local news, to newspapers that were within Ybor City itself, because it had its own press culture. So there were at least 4 to 5 newspapers at any given time in Spanish. And the lector was also translate from other languages, news from around the world.
Interesting. So, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So when you, so the lector was highly educated. There's one woman who I talked about briefly. Her name is Luisa Capetillo. And Luisa Capetillo, she is the only non lectora in Ybor City. So the only woman to ever hold that position. But she was a lectora in Puerto Rico prior to coming to Ybor City. And she comes to Ybor City because she's exiled from Cuba, where she's working at the time. She's exiled for wearing pants, which was illegal.
Evans, yes.
But while she's in Ybor City, right, she's a lectora, but she's also a writer. And she writes the first feminist treatise to come out of Latin America and to be popularly published. And she publishes it before coming to Ybor, but after living in Ybor, she updates it. And she publishes it with a local anarchist press. And so one of the things that I talk about, it's not just that the lectores or the lectoras are sharing, or they're certainly informing, but they're also learning from the people who they're interacting with as well. The Luisa Capetillo is an example of that. La Gaceta, is the longest surviving newspaper to come out of Ybor City. It still exists. You can subscribe to it. The same family actually owns it. But
the stories are in 3 different languages.
They're in 3. Yeah, now it's in 3 different languages. Initially, it was in Spanish only. Mm-hmm. But the person who developed it, his name was Victoriano Mantega. And Victoriano, he was a lector, and he leaves and starts a newspaper because it becomes like the mouthpiece for the community after the lector position ends, mm-hmm. which ends in the 1930s when manufacturers are able to have more control over the factories themselves.
Yeah. Your book uses the word Latinidad. What does that mean? Because I'm sure a lot of people will be coming across that for the first time.
So Latinidad means, it would directly translate to Latinness, or Latinoness is how I translate it in the book. So Latinoness is like a sense of self, of what it means to be Latino, which there's many terms that we can use today, right? Latino, Latina, Latinx, or Latine. Depends on your flavor. Any of them will work. But in the book, one of the things that I'm talking about is the way that those from Ybor City oftentimes describe themselves, and the words that we oftentimes hear used, is a term called Latin. And in the book, I use Latino and Latina intentionally because it's the words that were used when people were talking about themselves in their own print culture. But then there also was a political connection to it later on. Those who remained intellectually connected to the spirit of Ybor, like the writer Jose Iglesias, he starts referring to himself as Latino by the time you get to the 1980s. And the sense of being part of a pan-Latinidad experience within the United States emerges as in the wake of the civil rights movements, right? Where you're seeing that there is a national connection to what does it mean to be somebody who immigrates from a specific Latin American background and has to figure out what it means to live in the United States. Right, the term Latino, any of the words I use, right, Latino, 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 Latinx, Latine, isn't something that you would necessarily use outside the United States. It's something that emerges when communities become a conglomerate, right, when people start to understand themselves as interconnected and as part of a similar history that might have different backgrounds depending on where you're living, but to where either through language or through culture where there's a sense of similarity. And that was one of the things I really wanted to do, because we don't always think about people from Ybor when we think about Latino history.
That's true.
And we think about Miami. So yeah. Inserting this here.
One of the things that surprised me, but shouldn't have in the book, was the difference between the treatment of light-skinned and dark-skinned folks in Ybor City.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to put this in the book together to talking about the difference between what it meant to be a Cuban who, right, I say white, or a Cuban who is Black, right? Somebody who is Afro-Cuban. And initially, right, those who are immigrating in the 1880s are coming from Cuba in a working class background where there is a lot of social mixing and also to where laws that regulate segregation don't exist on the island the way they exist in Florida, right? The idea that people could not hold the same jobs, or that they could, or that certain people couldn't live in certain spaces, or that they couldn't go inside restaurants, or that they couldn't go into public pools or into theaters, or, you know, any other space that they couldn't, that somebody couldn't go into, is not something that is necessarily inherent to those who are coming to Tampa. But that doesn't mean that racism didn't exist on the island. It certainly did, but it was enforced by social standards, which, right, when I'm teaching my students, that's always the harder one to understand.
Yeah.
But the idea that there might not be a law that says that somebody can't do something, but the idea that having an interracial relationship isn't accepted, or that a child isn't treated the same way if they have mixed race parentage, or that perhaps somebody's allowed to go in a restaurant, but is it going to be comfortable for them to be there? Or somebody walks in and sits in a theater and everybody moves from sitting nearby them, right? That there were, that racism certainly existed and had a real impact, but it wasn't regulated in the same way. But in Ybor City, those lines become more rigid over time, especially as Ybor City becomes a part of the city of Tampa. Segregation laws then apply to Ybor City. And as things become increasingly restrictive, right? If one thing that you can do in Tampa is gain power or get access to jobs or security outside of Ybor City by being as close to white as you can be, part of that is not being Black. And the choices that people make very much aligned with that. So the sense of solidarity that you see at the beginning of the book really begins to wade away, and who you are and what your race is, even within the community, has a real impact on what your life looks like by the 1960s. I talk about one person who, when I talk about World War II, I explain that if you were somebody who was light-skinned and coming from the community, you had one experience in the armed forces. Whereas if you were Black, you had a totally different one, which meant when people returned home, many of those who were Afro-Cubans who perhaps would have been a part of, you know, mutual aid networks or community networks, mm-hmm. now join the NAACP, right? They understand themselves differently. They're saying, you know, like, I'm not going to be treated or accepted in the same way as this person who lived next door to me in Ybor City. And this, you know, notion of civil rights really has saliency. But while you see Latinos marching alongside each other in protests of fascism, you don't see the same sense of solidarity when it comes to civil rights along the line of race.
Yeah. What really got my attention was the one anecdote where you're talking about how everybody was part of one social club.
Yes.
And then they all split, and the whites went one way and the Blacks went the other way.
No, absolutely. Yeah, so there is a network of mutual aid societies, which is a pretty cool concept. That in the way they existed in Ybor City, they provided insurance, disability insurance. They had education programs. They had bars. They had dances. They brought people from Cuba to who put on plays. They brought people to sing opera from Spain. Right? They were really incredible spaces, and they still exist. The actual facades exist today, with the exception of the original Afro-Cuban Club. But the Afro-Cuban Club wasn't original at all, which I'll get to. So the original Cuban Club was called El Liceo Cubano, and then it becomes El Club Nacional. But in the late 1880s, it splits into two different mutual aid societies. And the only records that survive explaining what happens are those testimonies told by Cubans who were white. And what emerges are two different mutual aid societies. One is the Círculo Cubano, the Cuban Club, as it exists today. It's on La Avenida de la República de Cuba, I believe, in Ybor City. And the other one that emerges is the Sociedad Martí Maceo. So the Sociedad Martí Maceo is named after José Martí and Antonio Maceo, who was an Afro-Cuban who fought in the war for Cuban independence. So the name is acknowledging a sense of unity between the two, kind of as a like, hey, like you're breaking from this notion. But all Afro-Cubans must join the Sociedad Martí Maceo if they chose to be a part of a mutual aid society and could not be a part of the Cuban club. after the 1880s. So it's kind of the first and most noticeable form of segregation that affects the community.
You have a unique perspective, and I'm going to widen way out here. You know, you're Latina, your backgrounds are in Ybor City. You're also a historian. You are a professor at Texas A&M University. What do you see as the differences between how outsiders perceive Florida versus what you know as a historian in Florida is the reality that history defines our state by?
I mean, when I there's a few things. One of the things I can see right behind, I know listeners can't see, but right behind Craig is his, you know, cover of Oh Florida, which I feel like sums up what so many people think of Florida. I even get text messages of memes or headlines from friends whenever something happens, because I feel like I am the forever Floridian apologist. I'm like, no, it's really not that nuts, I swear. Although right now we're really, you know.
Just embrace it. Just embrace it.
That is what it is. Right. So, I mean, from the outside, and I also write about this in the book, where our image of Florida is that it's a place where you go to the beach. It's a place where you go to play. It's a place where, you know, it is in the South, but perhaps not of the South. And the picture that I work to paint, especially in the introduction, in the first chapter of my book, is that Florida really is a Southern state. And it just does a really good job of covering it up. right. It's more the idea of what we
Klan?
Want.
What? Do we have the Klan here? Oh, heavens. That don't
right?
Don't
that say the that. Klan yeah. still marches in Jacksonville, right? That the leader of the Klan is active in Florida, right? And is right here. Right. That you have a history of policing that was led by vigilantism, right? All of these things are very much a part that slavery, what very much was here.
Yeah.
Right, that we think of Florida as somehow being divorced from all of these things, and that we associate it with places like Tennessee or Mississippi or Alabama. But it very much happened in Florida as well. And when you understand that about Florida, the other things that happen, especially right now in the present, seem to have a lot of context and a lot of history and a lot of precedent. And it doesn't necessarily come from out of nowhere. The difference is that it depends on how we're defining Texas in the moment, if we're defining it as South or, you know, Southwest. But if we're putting in the Southwest category, then Florida becomes the most diverse, you know, Southern state. And even when you place it next to Texas, there is a much broader Latinx diversity within Florida than in any other place. But those things don't mean that Florida isn't a Southern state. It doesn't mean that these tenets in this history don't underline its politics, how the state operates. It just means that there's more people and more ways for it to get increasingly complicated, that it doesn't look black and white, but the legacy of those things are very much alive. So that's one of my main things is if you take Florida for what it was and what history is, all this stuff makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, that's true. One of the most heartbreaking anecdotes in the book is the efforts at urban renewal in Ybor City. And particularly when this, I've forgotten the name, I'm sorry, but they had lived in their house for years and years and years. And then one day someone from the urban renewal from the city shows up and says, you have to move. Thank you very much. We're going to make all of this look nice. And the woman dies of a heart attack.
Yeah.
And the husband says, I can't deal with this. I have to leave. And then I think they made like what the off ramp for I-4. Is what replaced their house,
which they don't even build until the early 2000s, right?
Yeah.
And this whole scene that I paint, you know, happens in the 1970s. So you have an over 30-year period where this kind of just lays fallow. So the process of urban renewal, it very much affected Ybor City. Ybor City was huge. It was over 40 miles on the outskirts of But all of that's gone now. The worker housing, by and large, is gone. The areas where you see the I-4, I-275, that is what Ybor City was, as well as portions of West Tampa. Not only was there, you know, issues with the way that cigar manufacturing operated and that people's work changed, but also where they could live changed. Right? Urban renewal is kind of a tale as old as time, where the state and the city made decisions of what they were going to privilege, and that was going to be transportation and expansion for what they understood at the time as the public good, and that people had asked for these things. But it came at the price of mass displacement of especially Black and Latinx populations throughout the United States. But the Ybor City, by the time you get to the 60s and late and early 70s, has very much become it's a working class neighborhood. People are poor, right? There's little work employment opportunity, but it also has a high Black population that it didn't necessarily have before. And by Black, I mean African-American, not Afro-Cuban. And it's interesting, right, that urban renewal comes through as the demographics of the city itself start to change. But yeah, urban renewal is very much a lasting legacy. What you see of Ybor City, and if you walk through it today, it's kind of like half of it was leveled without a plan. You have Hillsborough Community College that's there. You have a lot of empty parking lots.
We brought up urban renewal and the scourge of urban renewal in our Eatonville episode just outside of Orlando. Obviously, the same thing happened in Overtown, in Miami, another thriving African-American community bisected purposefully by urban renewal and interstates to bring it to its knees. It happened all over the country, St. Louis, Chicago, wherever you want to look. Urban renewal, quote unquote, urban renewal. Destroyed thriving Black communities by routing interstates purposefully through them. And you touched on my final question, and that is, you know, give us a snapshot of what Ybor City is like today.
Ybor City is it's a shadow of what it once was. There's an effort to make sure that Ybor City continues to live. The historic district is now 7th Avenue. It's still very much there. The original buildings are there by and large. It's very active. That's where you'll find all of the bars and you'll find the energy and restaurants. And that's where it is crazy if you are there anytime after the sun goes down on any given night. But one of the things that I say about Ybor City and that I think is important to remember is, right, my family is from there. And so I certainly have a particular emotional connection to it. But one of the things I talk about in the book is that if there's anything that last generation did that grew up there, was that they figured out a way for the concept of being of or from Ybor to survive beyond the confines of the physical community itself. And there's another historian, his name's Gary Mormino, and also a really smart local historian, does a lot of walking tours, which if anybody's down there, you find Manny Leto. He is the best tour guide in town. They both say something that I really agree with, which is that Ybor City has had many lives and many identities. And the historic, you know, association with Cubanness and with the Cuban cigar industry, it's one. But it also later became an arts district. It also later became a place where punk music thrived. It also later became a place that was a haven for queer men and women, right, in the 80s and the 90s. And Ybor City will continue to redefine itself. Ybor City was never necessarily meant to be, you know, the flashy area of town like South Tampa or Hyde Park, even though many people would like it to be. And I think Ybor City should, you know, have its purpose as necessary. Right now, there is a very active arts culture that's coming of age again. That is where you find ardent leftists and progressives still, not necessarily all who are connected to, you know, Latinx backgrounds, but it's where people find place. It's an important community. It just looks different than it used to. But I hope that it's able to survive its, you know, its funkiness in this age of wanting everything to look like it can be a tourist stop, which, you know, our perception of what Florida should be, nice and shiny and Disney World adjacent.
Sarah McNamara has been our guest, author, historian, professor. The new book published just last month, April 2023, Ybor City, Crucible of the Latina South. Congratulations on the book and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you all so much. Thanks for having me.
This was great. Thanks again. So, Chad, have you ever been to Ybor City?
I have not. I was in Tampa this spring and was right on the edge, but was tied up with other commitments and didn't get in there.
Well, if you ever go, you can actually go international while you're there.
How so?
A lot of people don't know this, but there is a park in Ybor City, Jose Marti Park, that is actually property of Cuba.
Mm.
So you can go to Ybor City, go to Jose Marti Park and step foot in another country while still being in Florida.
That's fascinating. Yeah, and I thought this was a damn good episode. I was really interested in these distinctions between the political perspectives of the various groups of Cuban migrants. We've done episodes on the Marielitos. We've done episodes on the initial wave. I shouldn't say that 1950s, 1960 wave of Cuban immigrants. You can go back in the archives and listen to those. And someone who we interviewed previously, I would recommend Nikki Fried, goes back and listens to those archives to understand these differences instead of, you know, the Democratic Party thinking all Latin
it's a monolith.
People. Yeah, exactly. Boy, has that ever fouled that party's attempts to run interference to the Republicans. That's interesting stuff there from Sarah.
Well, and just that image of 5,000 women marching from Ybor City to the steps of Tampa City Hall to basically say, we don't like what the fascists are doing in Europe, and it's affecting us here. And we want it to stop, and we want the United States to take a stand, is just an incredible mental image of these very determined women who were taking action. Welcome to Florida.
Welcome to Florida.